I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Joe Illick. He is director of the Santa Fe Concert Association. And Marsha Torabin is here. She's festival director of the Santa Fe Jewish Film Festival. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
And we're here to talk about a special event that's happening tonight. You will be doing a presentation called A Musical Journey, Joe, from Shtetl to Stage.
Yes.
What's that all about?
It's all about Fiddler on the Roof. We are going to be presenting the musical Fiddler on the Roof. The national tour is coming through Santa Fe, and the Concert Association is presenting it on March 10th at the Lenzing. So Marsha Torabin said, this is an amazing coincidence. The Jewish Film Festival is presenting the film Tevye, that's already shown, in early February. And that is a film based not on the musical Fiddler on the Roof, but the source of the musical, which is the stories of Sholem Aleichem, Tevye the Dairyman, as we were talking about. And she said, maybe an event could come between those two, where you talk about what happened in between those little Russian shtetls where the Jews were living in the late 19th century and the American musical that premiered in 1964, Fiddler on the Roof, which is based on life in one of those shtetls.
And one of the most popular musicals in the history of musicals.
The first Broadway musical ever to exceed 3,000 performances.
So let's talk for a moment, and we'll get back to the event, about the Jewish Film Festival. This is an ongoing series of films. It's not just like a long weekend or something like that.
That's right. We're structured a little bit differently to give our audience an opportunity to see all of the films that we screen. In a typical film festival, when it's over a weekend or a week, oftentimes you can't see every film. So this season we're doing 7 films, and the films that we bring are ones that inform about Jewish culture, history, religion, and or identity. And they're the same ones that you'd see if you went to one of the major Jewish film festivals in cities like New York or San Francisco. These films oftentimes don't make it to Santa Fe because of our smaller market size, but there's some real gems, some wonderful films, and we're thrilled to be able to bring them here.
Now, the last one you had, which unfortunately I didn't see, but it was Stories of Tevye the Dairyman, Sholem Aleichem. Those are very rich and important stories in the history of literature.
They are. And what's interesting about his stories of Tevye the Dairyman is that they were written in real time. They cover a span from about 1895 to 1914. And he's writing the stories over that period of time, and his characters are maturing, growing up, things are happening during that same period. What's interesting is that the stories that he wrote and the film Tevye, which was, it's a Yiddish film, it was made in 1939, and the play, the musical Fiddler on the Roof, although they're all related, they very much reflect the period in which they were created. And they don't all end the same. And in fact, the first time I saw Tevye, the film, the 1939 film, after seeing it, the first thing that popped into my mind was, this is not exactly like Fiddler on the Roof. It wasn't how I remembered Fiddler. And as a result, I wanted to see Fiddler to see how different it was. And I know it is different.
Very interesting. Now, are there a lot of films that are made in Yiddish language?
There are. There's over 100 films in Yiddish, and possibly more than that. So many of them were lost, but there are well over 100. It was a very rich film genre. Started off in Europe. There was film production centers in Warsaw, but also a very vibrant Yiddish film center in New York. And in fact, Tevye, which is interesting, it takes place on the shtetl, but the movie was filmed in Long Island on a potato farm.
Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Now, are young people still growing up learning Yiddish anywhere?
There's been a resurgence. There's been an interest, I'd say, in the last 20 or 30 years. Amongst younger people, you're seeing Yiddish being offered on college campuses. There's a wonderful Yiddish book center that's back in Amherst. And so there has been a renewed interest in the language, and a lot of effort has been put into translating these Yiddish works that had, to some extent, been lost.
And so it's not exactly a living language the way it used to be, but it's more now a kind of cultural preservation.
That's a very good description.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
But there are still millions of people that speak Yiddish and understand Yiddish.
There are. As I say, part of the younger generation is also learning. But, mm-hmm. I mean, around the turn of the century in New York City, that was the predominant language of the Jewish community there.
Right.
And so that's what you don't have anymore, where being the language of the Jewish community. Yiddish was also something that brought together Jews from very disparate countries and backgrounds. I mean, Jews did not have a state, but they had a language. And Yiddish was that unifying language right. for the Jewish people.
My father spoke and read Yiddish, and he wasn't even Jewish.
Oh, my goodness.
He was Italian.
Oh, you're kidding. So how did he...
He thought it was so interesting that he learned it.
Oh, my goodness. That is fascinating.
So it's interesting how languages evolve and grow and die and are revived. But anyway, let's get back to the question of the event tonight. So the musical journey from shtetl to stage, we're not talking history as much now as we are this musical history.
We're talking both. The thing that Marcia said that's so wonderful is that each generation of Jews who's retold the story has told it through the eyes of their generation. So Jerry Bach and Sheldon Harnick, who wrote the words and the music for Fiddler on the Roof, grew up in the United States. And one was born in Chicago and one was born in New Haven. And so their experience had been completely different from people a generation or two generations before them. And so it's not surprising that the ending would be different. But the theme that they capitalized on is a universal theme, which is that change happens in our world, and sometimes we embrace it and sometimes we fight it kicking and screaming. Part of the reason, as you said, that Fiddler on the Roof is so popular from its very first production is that it spoke to everybody. It spoke about parenthood and our children growing up, and you know, as they move away from us, we might be happy and we might be unhappy about the circumstances. And then, of course, it tells the story of what happened in those shtetls. In Fiddler on the Roof, there's one pogrom, a small pogrom, but of course, anybody watching the show, regardless of what their cultural background is, realizes that that one pogrom was one of thousands and thousands that were going on, and that the Jews had to keep moving and moving and moving. Finally, in the United States, American musical theater wouldn't exist without, I would say, 90% of the people that wrote musicals were Jewish. So whether you're thinking of the 1960s, something like this, or going back to Gershwin and Rodgers and Hammerstein and Lawrence Hart too, and Irving Berlin and Harold Arlen, you know, all the great Jewish composers brought traditions from Europe, musical traditions, and as they assimilated, these traditions assimilated into our stage, but they also created a whole genre that's now, you know, the musical theater of America.
And it's also so interesting to look at how any immigrant culture views a place where they had never lived, whether they're romanticizing
right.
it, whether they're getting it right. Are you even supposed to get it right?
I think in this case, they didn't romanticize it, but they didn't try to get it right in details. I think they tried to get it right in spirit. And I think they succeed completely in that. But as you say, they never lived there, so they didn't know. Fiddler on the Roof is told in very simple terms. So they'll talk about the rabbi and the mothers and the sons and the daughters. So they're creating a world without being tremendously specific. Tevye has five daughters, and three of them get married within the course of the story that's told.
Right. It's kind of like Jane Austen.
Yes.
Go ahead.
When you look at the film Tevye, it's a much, much darker story. Tevye was filmed right before the onset of World War II. And so the anti-Semitism that was rampant in Europe at the time affected the way in which the characters in the film were portrayed. So it's a much darker picture than what you get in Fiddler. And the people that the director, the stars that are in Tevye, they came from these shtetls. This is their firsthand experience. Or if they didn't, it was their parents. So this was their life. As Joe was saying, now you're several generations later. By the time you get to Fiddler, it's looking back with more nostalgia on a past that you didn't actually live through yourself.
Exactly.
Nostalgia, and no matter how much you empathize with somebody that's been living through pogroms, you know, month after month, you don't have the same feeling of being crushed by it that you do in hindsight, which is, you know, it's how we stay alive as a race, that we can empathize without having to literally relive. And so Fiddler is a very empathic story, but I wouldn't say that Jerry Bach or Sheldon Harnack set out to really tell the story the way it was in the movie with such intensity.
Right. We're talking to Joe Illick of the Santa Fe Concert Association and Marcia Torbin of the Santa Fe Jewish Film Festival. Now, the event tonight, it's not only a musical journey, but, let's start with the musical journey. Where does the musical journey begin?
Long before Sheldon Harnack is born. So we're going to trace the roots of Jewish music and see how much of that makes its way into the score of Fiddler on the Roof.
And what are some of those roots?
I can't tell you how many thousand years ago they began, but those roots begin the moment that the interval of the augmented second begins to become part of everybody's melodic vocabulary, so that instead of da 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 da, we have ya da dee 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 ya ya ya. Okay, that's a tiny unit that plays over and over in real traditional Jewish music, but also in Fiddler on the Roof and other musical pieces that try to recreate that flavor.
Right. And is there a reference that is thrown into other kinds of music to refer
exactly
to that genre?
But the composer was able to create Fiddler on the Roof without actually drawing on original source material. There's not a lot of reproduction of full tunes.
So you will be playing the piano as part of the demonstration?
Absolutely.
Now, there will also be a sing-along.
Because we all love to sing Fiddler on the Roof, so I'm sure that will be everybody's favorite thing.
And a reception and all kinds of good things.
There is a reception, and the reception is going to have food that is typical of what you would have had on the shtetl.
Really?
Yes.
What?
Well, we're going to have rugula and kickel and some gefilte fish and some herring and some other pastry delights. And part of this is coming direct from the Beverly, the Fairfax Robertson area, Pico area in Los Angeles, which is a very Jewish area. We've brought back pastries from there, flew them back over back to Santa Fe.
Oh my goodness.
So it's going to be just a real treat.
Amazing.
A musical treat and a food treat.
And a singing treat.
And a singing treat for sure.
Now, meanwhile, Fiddler on the Roof is going to happen on Sunday, the 10th of March at the Lenzic. Tell us about that production.
Every so often, they'll mount another national tour of Fiddler on the Roof. And this actually brings together some actors who've done it on other national tours. I think some of them have performed in it, you know, upwards of 1,000 times. I know that there are some shows where you really couldn't do 1,000 performances and still feel fresh about it. Because, you know, I've had the opportunity to do some things nearly that many times. But there are other pieces, and Fiddler on the Roof is one of them, where it only gets better. And so the relationship of these actors to one another is so strong, I think it'll be a really moving, wonderful production of Fiddler on the Roof from this national tour.
Excellent. Now, what's the next film in the Santa Fe Jewish Film Festival?
Our next film is this Sunday. It's a film called Precious Life. It won the Israeli Academy Award for Best Documentary. It's a film that the New York Times called remarkable and the Wall Street Journal called enthralling. And when you can get two papers who are so far apart politically to think the same film is really fantastic, it's saying something about the film.
Very interesting. What's it about?
It's a story about a Israeli doctor and a Palestinian family that have a small child that has a very serious and fatal immune disorder. And it's a story of how the Israeli doctor saves this child's life. But it's also set against the backdrop of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And it's a story told in a very personal way. So it's you get a sense of what's happening on a level that you don't often see in film. It's not the sort of the dramatic, you know, rockets going and protests and so on. It's a story of a doctor and a Palestinian family. And the reporter who facilitates a donor coming forward to actually pay for an operation.
Mm.
And so the Santa Fe Jewish Film Festival is ongoing, and the Santa Fe Concert Association has a fabulous season.
We're ongoing, too.
You're ongoing, too, and you've had one sold-out show after another.
Thank you. We've had a really successful season.
What is coming up that you'd like to let people know
about?
Well,
we have Wynton Marsalis coming up next week, but it's completely sold out.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I can't say, I guess if you really, 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 really want to see it, you should stand in the box office and just
and
cross your fingers. Yeah.
I should add, actually, Precious Life is sold out, but we're arranging for a second screening because of interest in this film. We're also interviewing the director, who is in Israel.
And that is an advantage that film has over live performers.
That's right. You can't arrange a second screening, although they do it with the Met high-definition operas.
They do it, yeah.
All right. Well, Joe Illick is the director of the Santa Fe Concert Association. Marcia Torbin is festival director of the Santa Fe Jewish Film Festival. What are your websites?
SantaFeConcerts.org.
And SantaFeJFF.org.
So the event tonight, A Musical Journey from Shtetl to Stage, is, that's hard, that's a tongue twister, from Shtetl to Stage.
You got it.
Is at Temple Beth Shalom.
That was
at
stunning.
At 7 o'clock tonight. And should we listen to some music?
What a great idea.
What are we going to listen to?
Why don't you play Tradition?
All right. Here we go.
Fiddler on the roof. Sounds crazy, no? But in our little village of Anatevka, you might say, every one of us is a fiddler on the roof, trying to scratch out a pleasant, simple tune without breaking his neck. It isn't easy. You may ask, why do we stay up there if it's so dangerous? We stay because Anatevka's our home. And how do we keep our balance? That, I can tell you in one word, tradition. Tradition, tradition. Tradition, tradition, tradition. Tradition.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Victor Talmadge. He is a professor in the Performing Arts Department at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design, and he has conceived of and directed a new documentary theater piece called Cold Water. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And Amy Bingen is here, and she is an actor in the piece. Welcome.
Thank you.
So this is a very interesting thing. When we think about documentary theater piece, I think many of us go straight to the Laramie Project. What is documentary theater?
Documentary theater is theater which is based on actual testimony of living human beings around a certain issue. It was pioneered by Anna Deavere Smith, who did two one-woman pieces where she went into various communities that had experienced trauma in the communities, interviewed members of the community, and then performed and played those characters in the community who dealt with that traumatic experience.
And I have to say, I saw her perform in Santa Fe, and it was some of the most powerful work I've ever seen in my life.
It's really, she's a brilliant performer. I had the privilege of working with her in the 80s in Berkeley, California, and actually she influenced me in starting to work in this kind of genre. So I actually think of her as my main influence in terms of exploring this kind of work. And so that's basically what documentary theater is. You mentioned the Laramie Project. The Laramie Project was a piece based around a central theme. One of the ways that we differ from the work that the Laramie Project did, and we're closer aligned with what Anna DeVere, her work is that we do not bring any fictional writing material to the process. The Tectonic Theater Company, who did the Laramie Project, they have professional writers that they bring on scene, and they try and weave a cohesive story together, interjecting their own material to try and create a narrative form.
Well, that's one of the challenges of a project like this. You go out with a theme, and in this case, it's agua fria, cold water, agua fria village, the whole history of water in Santa Fe and water rights and water use, and it's a thorny subject and has been as long as there have been people here and will be as long as there are people here. You collect that material, and then making a narrative arc, making a theater piece work with only the words you've got, that's tricky business.
It's very tricky business. I mean, to the credit of the students, including Amy, of course, who have been working on this since the fall, after we collected the interviews from all of the citizens and members who were dealing with this theme of water in the Southwest, particularly the Santa Fe area, it then became our task to try and find some kind of narrative idea around it. What we decided on was the San Ysidro Day Festival, the Blessing of the River Festival, and so we found our way to tell the story, our way into the story, which was around the day of this festival and the procession that accompanies the Blessing of the River. So the stories of these Agua Frian residents are centered around this event, which is the San Ysidro Day Festival.
Now, what was the role of the students and the eventual actors in the play of collecting and editing the material in the first place?
Amy?
Well, I can answer that. Well, what we did, as Victor had mentioned, in the fall was we had everybody come in, and we set up a video camera, and so we were able to tape their interviews. And then what we did after that is pick somebody to be assigned to said interview, and you would just transcribe. So you would take the time to watch the video and word for word notate what they were saying, basically just to have it in document form to refer to later. Gave those to Victor, had those all in a folder, and then from that our editors that we had chosen for the project took all that information and then, using their exact words, kind of copied and pasted, creating dialogue, creating conversation, building dynamic relationships between all the characters or all the people we were able to interview, and kind of create a story out of that. So that was really cool to be able to watch the interviews, revisit them, have them available to us, follow the story, ask questions to them, and really follow everything that was going on from the beginning.
And what I did was I asked a couple of students to act as senior editors, and they did the first pass of the piece after a number of meetings with me where we just outlined what the story should be like. And then I asked the students, including Amy, who had interviewed these people, who they would like to play if they had a choice. And they made a list of their favorite characters. And over the Christmas break that we had, I cast the show. And when we came back and had our first draft, we did a series of read-throughs where we would read the pieces, and then I would ask the students what they thought of the storyline and what was weak and what was strong and where they thought we could do improvements, where we could cut and paste, and that's how the piece evolved. And it was just about 3 weeks ago, I think, that we had our final draft.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very interesting. Now, how did you find and choose the people to interview in the first place?
About 5 years ago, one of the former faculty, full-time faculty members, a woman named Cheryl Odom, who was actually a character in the play, when I was first looking at the position at Santa Fe University mentioned to me that there was this community that she thought would make a great topic for the documentary theater piece. And at the time, she mentioned a number of citizens who would be very interested in telling their story. So when it came about doing this piece, and this is the second piece that we've actually done at the school. The first piece was on the Death March, Bataan Death March. And
that was awesome.
Thank you. At the time that we decided to do this piece on Agua Fria, I recontacted those people in the village of Agua Fria. And they have a village association. So the first thing that I did was go to the village association meeting, tell them what we were planning on doing. This was in September of 2012. And then handed out a sheet and asked those people that were interested in being interviewed to sign up on the sheet. And that's how we started. And from there, we got other references. And it was just it's a question of doing some journalistic legwork.
Absolutely. I mean, this is, when you talk about documentary theater, it really is equal parts of both.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I was thinking about this in terms of, I mean, you interview people and then you essentially transcribe those interviews and cut them together. And in that sense, it's a similar process to what you would be doing if you were making a film.
A documentary film.
Yeah.
And not only that, but I've read this Ruminations of Rodin, the sculptor. And he talks about looking at a block of marble and not knowing what the sculpture is going to be until he starts chipping away. That's the process we used too. We had no idea really what the storyline or theme was going to be until we had collected all the material and actually started looking at what we had. So it's very much like the process they use in documentary filmmaking and in sculpting.
It's very interesting to me that you say that it's like a sculpture that starts as a solid block and you're chipping away at it. I would have thought you would use more like a metaphor of collage, where you're taking lots of different pieces, different materials, and putting them together.
Yeah, well, I think that's the other side of the tube in terms of examining this process. For me, it really is this big conglomeration of things that are already together, and it's up to us to try and uncover what the story is inside of that.
Yeah.
So that's why I use that metaphor.
Very interesting. We are talking to Victor Talmadge and Amy Bingen about Cold Water, the documentary theater piece that opens at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design tomorrow and runs for 2 weekends. So once you had all the material and you started crafting it and making a theater piece out of it, did you ever feel like there's some actual conceptual pieces missing and we have to go back to the source, the way a journalist might go back for more parts of the story?
I think definitely in terms of character development, yes, because at that point when we had finished the script, we were just assigned our characters, and we knew everybody that we had interviewed. You know, we had sat in on the interview, watched them and everything, but you definitely had to go back to the source and go back to, okay, why is this person saying this? Why is it important to them? What is going on? What is the relevance? And how can we tie this all into a story? So it makes sense with all of these different interviews we cut and paste. So you definitely had to go back and do your research. You know, I remember having to even look up, like, you know, what is this festival? What is this? You know, and we took a field trip to Agua Fria, so that was really cool. And we were able to walk the acequia and get a feel of the environment. But you definitely do have to go back and know what you're saying and listen and be present in the moment, because if you're not, you're just going to be up there saying these words that do mean something to someone, but what is the justice in that? What is the point in that? So it was, yes, and even still now in this dress rehearsal process, I'm still going back to my script and finding new things and, you know, reading the story and reading all of the interviews over and over. So it's a never-ending process.
You know, and just hearing Amy talk and use terms like acequia, a year ago, even 6-7 months ago, most of my students didn't even know what the word acequia meant. So having, you know, for me, one of the most rewarding parts of this whole exercise is to introduce to my students the community that they study in.
Right.
And to introduce the community members to the school. And that kind of interchange, to me, is as valuable as the finished product itself. To be able to have my students not only comfortable and familiar with the stories of their community, but to have the community appreciate that there's someone outside of the community interested in bearing witness and telling their story.
Well, and it'll be so interesting, as it must have been for the Laramie Project and other projects of this nature, when the people who are the characters are sitting in the audience and see you, Amy, saying their words, and probably because you have the tapes, saying them with a similar accent and inflection and
trying.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think that's part of what's so powerful about this kind of theater, is that, I mean, I've seen people act in, for example, the Laramie Project or the Laramie Project 10 years later, who were passable actors, but when they have that source material, they become very, very good.
Right. And, you know, it's a very forgiving medium for actors, because already we have, as in Amy's case, she does a wonderful job, but she's playing someone who's a few years older than she is. And the process allows for gender-free, race-free, age-free casting. Because audience is very forgiving. They understand what they're watching, and they don't expect people who are 22 years old to have to be 45 years old.
Right.
So it's a very forgiving process on that level as well. But you're right. A lot of this stuff is extremely compelling. I'll be curious to see, and I know that my actors will, but how they rise to the occasion when they know that the people that they're playing are in the audience.
I'm nervous. I'm not going to lie. Actually, it was interesting. With we had a new an article come out in the New Mexican, and I was reading the article, and the lady I'm playing, actually, they interviewed her as well, Lois Montoya. And so, and I don't know, I became really overwhelmed in how she was talking about how happy she was that we're passionate in doing this project, and how excited that her and her husband William are to see the show. And I was like, oh gosh, okay, they're gonna be here opening night, gotta, you know, it's a right. little nerve-wracking, but I'm excited to see what their reaction is. I'm really excited.
Well, and you'll probably have the opportunity for feedback,
hopefully, to see them.
And the other wonderful thing is a lot of the community members have never seen live theater. And to introduce that medium to them in this way is also an incredibly rewarding experience.
Right, right. So we're talking about the documentary theater piece, Cold Water. Now let's talk about some of the themes in the piece. I mean, this is about Agua Fria, the street, the village, the water itself. And it goes back at least as far as the memory of the oldest characters whom you interviewed.
Right. Historically, the stories go back 400 years with the founding or the entrance of Don Diego and his party into the area, the current area. And the themes, I think, you know, one of the things that I've learned in theater over my years is that the more specific you are, the more universal the theme. And in dealing with the issues of Agua Frians, what we're really dealing with is the issue of the themes of water, of loss, recovery, of how people band together within challenging circumstances. And as we tell these individual stories, all of these themes arise. The piece is actually constructed in two parts. No intermission. It runs about an hour and a half. And the first part was this celebration of water, because one of the things that I thought would actually highlight the idea of scarcity is to have in the first part an abundance of water and have the two ideas play off of each other. So the first part of the piece is extremely experiential and expressionistic, and it's a celebration of different rituals around water, and we actually have running water on stage. And then we cut off the water, and then we start telling the story of Agua Fria. So, again, the themes are myriad. There are numbers of themes of loss, redemption, hope, salvation.
Development, cultural clashes, family feuds.
Exactly.
And all those kinds of things. I mean, I think one thing that's so... There's a joke, you know, how many Santa Fe's does it take to change a light bulb? One to change it, and four to talk about how much better the old one was. And we see that everywhere.
Right.
And this idea that the past was better, whether the past be the year 1800 or whether it be 1970 or whether it be 5 years ago.
Right.
And I think some of those things come up even in this play.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Oh, yes. And they're unavoidable.
I think with my experience coming into this project, like, you don't think about water. It's a resource that you have, at least I have. I don't have to worry about it every single day. And coming out of it, you really start to see it through somebody else's eyes, to see it through their shoes, that this is their life, and this is what they're passionate about, and this is what they need to survive. And it's amazing. It's amazing to go from this one view of, oh, you know, I really wouldn't care or wouldn't think about it, you know, so much in my daily life, to being this person who does depend on it every single day and fights for it every single day, spends all of their time, all of their money, all of their dedication towards this project. And it's amazing where you can come from in the last few months of that whole realization. So it's a play in which you have to take what you can from it. You know, we're not forcing anything. We're not throwing it in your face. We're simply presenting a story that is here. And it's going to be here for a very long time, at least, you know, as long as water exists. Who knows? At this point, you'll find out maybe in the show. But
as long as water exists.
Yeah, right.
You'll see. And
that's a very good point Amy raises, because one of the things we try and do is not bring a bias to the material. Mm-hmm. Of course, in the fact that we edit the material, there is a inherent, ingrained kind of bias. But we try and not take sides and let the sides speak for themselves and let the audience walk away with what they get from the piece.
One of the things that I got just from reading it, I haven't seen a rehearsal or the play yet, but is that human beings, no matter how much they have in common, even family members, if you're not careful, tend to get into fights with each other and to get divisive, even when they have interests in common. And it's so frustrating.
Yes.
To witness and to be part of.
It is. And you know, we close the piece with a segment which is all about the communities trying to get together over common themes. And one of the things that is brought up in this final segment of the play is, as you mentioned, the fact that everybody is literally related, you know, in the community and in the greater area of Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. And how that relationship also parallels the fact that the people are related on a macro level as well. Yeah. And we're all concerned with the same issues, and the idea is, how do we come together over those issues towards some kind of positive end? And not a divisive end.
Another thing that came up for me was, what is progress?
Right.
I mean, do we want to go back to a farming acequia system? Was that really as good as we have it in our memory in the first place? What kind of positive development do we have? What kind of, like, super greedy, lying, cheating, stealing development do
right.
we have?
Exactly.
And
you know, there is a character in the play who says, without the dams that we have that kind of dammed up the acequias, we wouldn't have indoor plumbing. You know, that's just a fact of life. So, as you say, you know, you make your choices. What's
right.
important to you? To have indoor plumbing or to have free running water where there is no control and nobody has control over the water?
And that is a question that's a real question. It's not just a rhetorical question. And people say in the play, well, I could go to the acequia, get a bucket, heat it up, and that's my shower. And for those of us who have lived for any time at all in third world countries, that's exactly what you do.
Yeah.
And it's fine.
Right. 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 It's doable. People have lived like that for hundreds and hundreds of years. But for those of us that have never done that, it's the other side of the moon.
Right.
You know, it's nobody would ever think of doing that, or only if we had to in the most dire sets of circumstances. So you're right. One person's cake is another person's poison. So.
There's also references to Bolivia and the great water issue that happened there when they tried to privatize water and the huge uprising that happened, which I think, I mean, I couldn't tell whether you guys as interviewers pushed that or whether it came out by itself, because it's such an important example of the people just saying, of the people just putting their feet down.
Well, there was a gentleman that visited the campus in the fall who was the the father of the protests in Bolivia. And he came and visited, and we decided, since we were dealing with water, to go and tape that interview. And when we translated the interview, it became clear that what he was talking about was so similar to what was going on in terms of the issues that it was an important character to include. And that's how that got incorporated into the piece. And he becomes, you know, his issues become the kind of one-world communal issues that the world is facing, and he becomes that voice for us in the piece.
Yeah, definitely very reflective in the sense that here we are in Agrofria, but let's think about the whole picture. You know, it's happening right here where we are, but really it's going on in the whole world, and so everybody's affected by this valuable resource. So I really enjoyed that interview because it really, you know, it's a nice touch towards the end of the show in the sense that, hey, this is everywhere. This is a universal theme. Who knows when water will someday run out? We really need to start focusing on this, not just here, not just in the village, not just in the country, but everywhere, because it's going to affect everybody.
Well, and there's two parts of that. One is that water is, in fact, a worldwide system. We have our watersheds, but it's also the way clouds move and rivers and oceans and El Nino and all those things are basically part of a giant worldwide system. And then the other part is, how are people actually dealing with the same problems that arise everywhere?
Exactly.
And how can we communicate more with each other about those things and see how other people handled it?
That's exactly right. And again, the process that we employ is to just present the material. And what audiences walk away from in terms of making those connections, that's really up to them. Because we, as part of this process, do not want to be shaking our fingers at anybody.
Right. Now, this project, Cold Water, Agua Fria, is going to be performed this weekend and next weekend. Is it the kind of thing that you could then put it on the road or get different actors to do it? I mean, do you see a longer life for the piece?
You know, that's always the million-dollar question in terms of any production. I think, as in the Bataan piece that we did a couple of years ago at the school, and other pieces, documentary theater pieces that I've done, these things are eminently transferable. Whether or not there would be interest, I mean, the set that we have is not a set that we could transport, but a new design for the set. You know, it's always difficult to see other actors in these roles because these actors have lived with these characters forever. But I certainly could see the piece living beyond my life as the director or any of the actors' lives as actors in the piece, because I think the themes are universal themes. So I think the piece could transfer to any part of the world, really.
Yeah, I mean, Laramie Tectonic was the same problem. You had these people in the Tectonic Theater Company who actually went to Laramie, Wyoming and interviewed people and got to know them so well. And then it's been performed by high schools.
Exactly.
It's been performed everywhere. And sometimes you have 10 people doing it, and sometimes you have 7 people doing
exactly
it and taking multiple characters. And it works.
Yes. Yes. And, it remains to be seen, since this is a brand new piece, how well this piece works and translates over time. But we will see when the audience is there what the reception will be.
I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but having read the script, I would love to see Chicano theater troupes somewhere else, like in California or other parts of the
country. Oh, yeah, that's a great idea.
Doing it.
Yeah. It's a wonderful idea. And there is something extremely culturally centered to the piece. And, in fact, a lot of internally in our script and in our production, we have a number of Spanish-speaking actors who are speaking in Spanish throughout the piece. And we have other actors translating what they say. So
good.
I think it would certainly lend itself to that.
Yeah, very much so. And it's always good in a piece where you have the original interviewees being native Spanish speakers to have people who can pronounce the words properly.
Very important. Correct.
Definitely.
So do you have actors playing multiple characters in this piece?
We do. We actually have these characters called our sprites, which they kind of, when they're in their sprite form, they kind of hover, they kind of watch everybody, poke you know, poke a finger at the situation or make a comment here and there to kind of, you know, spark a thought. So that's really an interesting character we have there. And then those three that we have are, you know, kind of also kind of like the chorus for the piece, you know, always that outside voice, you know, repeating certain phrases that we want to have stick within the piece as well. And those three are also playing a bunch of different characters. We have a developmental character, one of the gentlemen, I don't want to say who right away, you'll see in the show.
Okay.
is one of like a developmental contractor here in Santa Fe. We have him as played by multiple people. We have, you know, just different little roles as well. We have one lady playing a much older woman, but then going into sprite form, going into a mafia boss, going into all of these different characters to really set the scene. So we do have some of that.
So it's great. It's great exercise
definitely.
For an actor.
Oh, yeah. The stamina, making sure you have your each character, your cue. I mean, you know, the whole nine yards. So
yeah.
And what I like about the three of them is they really bring they really tie the whole piece together. And you know, I only play one character, and most of us only play one character that's from the village. But those three definitely bring the drive, bring the spark, you know, poking at it and lifting up those issues and not afraid to speak and not afraid to have fun on stage and playing in the water the whole time. So they're really cool, the little chorus that we have. So
yeah. It was important to have kind of a Greek choral addition to the piece. People who can guide the audience in terms of the ideas that are being presented, and also to help frame the different sections and different ideas of the piece. So we do that with these three characters, as Amy is saying. And, you know, there is a tradition in the New Mexican culture of water sprites, and that's what the costumes are modeled after,
these
water sprites.
So the play is called Cold Water. It is a documentary theater piece, and it opens tomorrow, Friday the 1st of March at 7 o'clock at the Greer Garson Theater, which is on the campus of the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And it's Friday and Saturday at 7 in the evening and Sunday at 2. And it runs for 2 weekends. And the Greer Garson Theater is on the Santa Fe University of Art and Design campus, not to be confused with the Greer Garson Sound Studio?
Studios, yeah.
Which is where the screen is, that wonderful movie theater. But don't go over there. Go to the theater. And is there a number that people can call for reservations?
The Lenzic Theater box office handles reservations.
Okay.
And there's a Greer Garson number. I think it's 473-6511.
And the Lenzic is 988-1234. Victor Talmadge is professor in the Performing Arts Department at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. And he conceived of this piece and is the director of the piece. And Amy Bingen is an actor in the piece. Now, are you a theater major?
I am. I'm a musical theater major, actually.
Really?
Yeah. So, like, for me, this whole process has been interesting, so I'm not used to plays so much as doing musicals, but...
So you sing and dance and act?
You know, sometimes, here and there. When I can.
Excellent. Well, it's been wonderful having all of you on the Radio Cafe, and we look forward to Cold Water.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.